Hello and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning the 12th of June. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
This week, Spanish Democracy Camp in Bristol. You might have noticed it in the city centre as you've been driving or walking past. We chat to four people who've been living in the city centre as part of the protests. And we also look back at the recent legacy of fascism in Spain as Anthea Page looks back at Guernica.
As well as the latest episode of the serial Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, we've also got Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide and poetry from Mark Sayers. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. It's also broadcast in Preston and it's in Albans on Radio Verulam. If you'd like to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square, and the details of that are at the end of the show.
If you've been driving or walking through the city centre, you might have noticed a bit of a camp going on by the fountains, by the statue of Neptune in the city centre, and that's the Spanish protests that have been going on. There's a Spanish community that have gathered around there in the city centre, and they're joining in protest, along with a lot of people who are protesting in Spain right now. And I'd like to introduce two people who've been there, Antonio Mayor and Anna Nordholm. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Antonio, briefly to start, what brings you to Bristol generally? How long have you been in Bristol?
Well, I've been living in Bristol for 6 years. My intention was to play some music,
yeah.
As obviously you know, most of the most beautiful music ever made is been composed in England. After a few years, I ended up studying media practice, and I'm trying to become a film documentarist.
Yeah. Okay. How about yourself, Anna? What brought you to Bristol?
Basically, I was studying in Spain, back in Spain, and I just finished it. And so I decided 1 year ago just come here and, you know, learn a bit of English and get some experience, work experience. So
okay. What has been going on in Spain? People may be vaguely aware that there are a lot of protests in Spain. In fact, there are a lot of protests all over the place generally, it seems, in the world right now. But what specifically is going on in Spain?
Well, I have to say that this movement didn't start in Spain because, as you might know, the first rise, it was in the North African countries.
Yeah.
You got countries like Egypt and Libya. I wouldn't say Libya, but, you know, the mass media is talking about Libya the same way. But what basically is happening is people are, you know, there's no hope anymore for young people to make a living in their lives because they don't know what to do. They just go on the streets and they show their anger and say, we don't like this. We want something new. Because they never had made democracy before. That's what they claim. I think, because I don't know the people who organized this movement in Spain and wrote this manifesto, but I think that they were very aware about what was going on there.
So they were inspired by the so-called Arab Spring that's going on in North Africa, but, I mean, are they not protesting more against sort of dictatorships and undemocratic practices, whereas in Europe it's more to do with cuts? Are they not two different sort of things, really?
What's the difference between dictatorship and the democracy that we have here now?
Yeah.
I don't see any difference. It's just, I think it's even worse in here because the lie is so big that it's horrible when you discover the truth.
Okay. And were you aware that a lot of people around you, a lot of your friends here in Bristol, they all felt the same way?
The thing is, today, everyone goes their own way. Nobody cares about anymore. About anybody anymore. We become so selfish in this society.
You say democracy is a lie. What do you mean by, you know, democracy is a lie? What do you perceive that we can do about it?
Yeah, I'm not a politician, but it's not very complicated to understand that many people are suffering and they don't have jobs and they struggle with their lives. They don't get enough money to make a living. I've been working for more than 16 years, and I got 37 jobs in my back. And I can tell you that all the time is the same pattern. Mm. You work for somebody, this person makes profits, they get rich, and you get poor. And everybody knows that, but the problem is because we are so selfish in our lives, we don't really communicate with each other, we don't understand what's going on, and some people are happy with the lives that they have, and some people don't.
Okay, Anna, I'll bring you in at this point. I mean, do you agree with, you know, what Antonio was saying? Do you think democracy is a lie as well?
Yeah, mostly, yeah, of course. It is a lie, obviously. But in my opinion, yeah, what I think is basically, it's not only all the system about where we work or where we are living at the moment. It's more like politics, yeah. You vote for someone expecting something and you didn't get that.
Right.
That's what I refer to lying, basically.
At what point did you all start to gather in the city centre and decide that you're going to sort of camp out, basically?
Well, basically, we organised this when we saw what was going on in Spain. Mm. It was very shocking because, in my opinion, I thought that the Spain was completely, you know, it was sleeping. And it's one of the reasons why I moved to England 6 years ago, because I couldn't understand why people were so unaware of the situation in the, what was going on in there. We decided to create this Facebook group where, you know, we were very happy that for people to raise up.
How many people roughly have you got there on a sort of temporary, long-term basis?
We are right now maybe working together in the camp, like 40 people.
40 people, okay. Yeah. And what sorts of different people have you had turning up? Is it mainly, you know, sort of Spanish and European?
There is a lot of Spanish, obviously, in there.
Yeah.
But it's not the only one. We got like one quarter of the people is English, maybe more. Also, we got people from different locations, like European, like Italian, French.
Some South American as well.
Yeah, South America, Asia, India, most of it, really. Students, workers.
How are the protests taking shape in Spain? I mean, here, I mean, we have the north of the Britain is usually classified as poorer than the south. I mean, are there more protests in some areas of Spain than others?
I think that the amazing thing, what I really like about this movement, and I don't know if I said before, but I never get involved in any political movement or social movement. And because of this manifesto, I realized that this war has been writing is for everyone.
Right. Okay. Well, what is your manifesto? Let's cut to the chase then.
This manifesto it says that, you know, we are ordinary people trying to make a living. For some reason, it's not working. We don't like the politicians, you know, in the government. Mm. We don't like the right. We don't like the left. It's been going on since the beginning of our democracy in 1977. And since then, we have seen that nothing is working properly. What we can see, and today, especially thanks to the social networks, we can see that there is so many things going on under the surface, not only in Spain, all around the world, that people are fed up. And I think that the light, the thing that starts everything, it was the fact that it's 40% of unemployment in Spain. Mm. In my opinion, and this is a personal opinion, the reason why I'm here is I'm trying to communicate with the English community and tell them that this is going to happen here very soon.
Okay, Anna, what would you say to people who are thinking, well, you know, this sounds quite interesting, but I'm not really sure, how am I going to help by turning up and staying?
Basically, the thing, we mostly share ideas, so we all got common things, like, think about, sorry about that. But basically, we are working together for get to this system, new system, call it that.
So you're going to try and work out a new way of living for society to work?
Yeah, mostly, I think so. And also, you know, it's not only working together, it's almost like teaching a school, you know, it's like people all the time sharing experience, different points of view, so it's okay. Like...
How can people get a hold of this manifesto so they can give it a proper read through?
Well, you can find it all over the net. We've got a Facebook group, which is called Acampada Bristol. Do you want me to spell it?
Yes, please, yes.
Yeah. We got the hash key, mm-hmm. and then ACAM,
yep.
PADA,
yep.
and then a space Bristol. Obviously, you can go to the city centre and collect the manifesto for yourself and have a chat with us.
Okay.
And we'll be very happy to speak about that. And I wanted to say what Anna said. We don't really know where we're going because we are, as I say, we are not politicians. We are just normal people. But I've been doing research on the website, and I can tell you that there's millions, thousands of people, very professional and ready to take over from tomorrow in all different aspects of society.
Are you talking about Spain here, yeah?
I'm talking about all over the world, because I think that what's going on in Spain, you know, we are here just to tell them that we support them, but at the same time we're here as well to try to communicate with the English community and tell them that this is going to affect them very soon.
So what's happening in Spain and how people are dissatisfied there affects England just as much?
Yeah, basically, because we are going to follow the same pattern, the same economy patterns.
Yeah.
So I think that I will say that there's there is this kind of a plan. They like these things to happen. I don't know why, but there's a lot of suffering and some people are enjoying it. Yeah, I've been take this, this. I would like to present to you guys to this lovely guy called Jimmy Khan. We have written a CD from him, and this is a very, very, very interesting musician. He's been working with the African communities for more than 6 years.
Right.
And I think that he got a really beautiful message to sow. So if you want to listen to one of the songs.
Please.
The song is called No Repatriation.
That was No Repatriation by Jimmy Khan. If you want to find out more about that, he's on the MySpace, myspace.com/JimmyKhanLive. Jimmy is spelled J-I-M-I, Khan Live. Or you can email him, jimmykhan@live.com. Antonio and Anna, thank you very much. But hang around because we're going to interview a couple of other people. Two people called Rich, who are also at the protest, Rich and Rich.
So with me now, I've got Richard Trigg and Richard Gadu. And both of you guys are living in the democracy camp in the centre at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, when we say living, can you kind of explain exactly what that means?
Well, for me, it is very much living, but obviously not completely. I still have my house in Bristol, and I have been using that because... the longer you spend there, as enjoyable as it is, it can be tiring and you do need to have time to sleep. And for people in general, I think we've got a lot of people involved. As Antonio says, it's about sort of 40 regular involved people. But obviously each of us have got like personal lives with jobs and family and such like that they need to attend to. So it's a situation where you give as much time and... involvement as you can.
How about you, Richard?
Me, I'm actually homeless at the moment, but I mostly stay there quite a lot to support stuff like that, but yeah.
So how's kind of your day-to-day life there? I mean, how do you kind of...
My day-to-day life is mostly helping out, getting more people, giving people leaflets, helping out, but yeah.
Do you find people understand why you're there?
Some of the people understand, but they want more information. But half of the people who actually chat to us has actually got us over Facebook, over half over the news, stuff like that, yeah.
How have you find people kind of coming up to you?
It's really interesting. I would say it's one of the most interesting aspects of the movement is the fact that we're interacting with such a variety of people. People like us come from different backgrounds, like different extents of interest in the situation. Some people are very aware of what's going on across like Spain, throughout Europe, and all the stuff that happened throughout the Arab Spring, but don't really have much knowledge when it comes to sort of like the like reactionary movements, if you will, like the camps which have been set up in Bristol or Brighton or across the world. But then on the flip side, like you do get people who have less interest and are more ready to heckle. Of course, Friday and Saturday nights is...
I can imagine. So how do you kind of cope with that maybe negative side to being in the camp?
I think it's something you come to expect it. You know that like it's not always going to be perfect. You're not going to win over everyone. But the attitude I take personally, and I'm sure it's shared by others, is the fact that like just give these people like your time and talk to them and explain why they're here and take it from there. Rich?
Yeah, definitely same.
So generally, would you say the reaction's been quite good?
We get quite a lot of people coming past, giving us a bit of grief, but it's fine. We quite a lot of people come past, giving us aggressive words. Some people say, "Why are you here for? What are you doing here?" We just tell them what's going on. And say, "Okay, yeah, cool. Sorry, I apologise for what happened. I didn't know what's going on, but yeah, that's right."
So, kind of, why personally, kind of, both of you there? Like, is it kind of political? Is it? You know, why? What's kind of driven you to go to the camp?
Well, it's driven me because I was actually walking past with a couple of my mates, and I've seen quite a lot of people there camping there, people chatting to other people. I just wanted to know what's going on. I've seen what's going on, and I'm liking what they're doing, and they're supporting, and I'm helping people in Spain. So I thought, yeah, I'll come down, I'll grab my tent, come down, support everyone and support people in Spain. So that's what I've been doing.
So, I mean, you mentioned that you were homeless. Do you think this has got a kind of, this is quite important for you?
It's helped me a bit. It's helped me a bit because people come down and say, yeah, I've got a place for you to stay. It's helping me quite a lot. There's people who's actually helping me find me a place as well now. So it's helped me quite a lot, definitely, as well.
Great. And what about you, Richard?
For me, the first I heard of this camping particular was I was at the Stocks-Croft Street Fest and was approached by a couple of girls who said that there would be a demonstration on the Sunday. Unfortunately, I wasn't going to be in Bristol for that, but when I got back on the Tuesday, I went with a friend and we went to see what was going on with the camp, and I spent the night talking to people who were there and learning more about that camp in particular. For the camp itself, I think that's a small look at it, but for me it's the next step in a long line of stuff. As of the end of last year, I started taking deeper interest in like current affairs and the way things are going, like in the UK, sort of starting with like education activism, looking at like the future of university fees and stuff like that, and then it rolls. Like from that, you start learning about more and more things, whether it be like NHS reforms or like major job loss around the UK, and like I see these things and I can see how awful they are, and I'm trying to find like way I can help change that, and the acampada I think is a great next step for that.
So you mentioned some other camps as well, and the acampada. Is this a kind of the beginning, do you think, of something bigger where people are going to take more personal choices to join in these types of actions?
Definitely. I think if we're looking like the whole movement, it's a very sort of something which is full of different catalysts. You could say that what's happened in Madrid and in Barcelona was a huge catalyst to start up the Acampada Bristol, but we're also seeing, like, just looking at the UK, there's camps in Brighton, in London, Manchester, Cardiff. That's just UK. It's all throughout the world. I'm not sure what the current statistic is, but I know that, like, sort of last Thursday, stats were showing that over 810 camps, like the one in Bristol, had been set up worldwide, stretching as far as, like, sort of like all across Europe, going into Asia, like out to sort of like Japan and China, in America, down to Australia, Asia.
So it's gathering momentum then. I mean, Richard, would you say there are more people joining on a daily basis?
Yeah.
So how many? How big is this going to get in Bristol?
I've no idea how big it's actually going to get in Bristol, but we're getting quite a lot of people helping us and supporting us in Bristol. We've got people coming to us, chatting to us, like, it's good. I think it's going to get bigger and bigger, really big.
Quite a lot of people seeing more tents arriving. Every day. Like, if I've been away and come back, like, there'll be an extra tent. And since our small move to our new location, we seem to have more space and more space for expansion, which is great.
Brilliant. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, if people want to find out more, I presume they just turn up at the camp and you guys will be there. And
I think that's pretty much the best thing. If people are interested in what's going on, perhaps they don't know too much about why we're there and what we're standing for, then please do not hesitate. Come and talk to us, because you will find someone who's willing to talk to you, perhaps offer you a warm drink and a biscuit.
Yeah. Well, sounds good. So where exactly in the centre is this camp?
Well, we were by the camped around the statue of Edmund Burke up until the end of last week, where a member of the council came down to talk to us, expressing that they were concerned that damage might be done to the statue and saying that they wanted us to move out a bit so they could, like, erect protection, sort of like scaffolding and boards to, like, stop any damage being made. To which we answered, we said, well, this is just further needless expenditure. It's something that we don't feel is necessary. We're happy to move along. So now we're situated sort of about 10-20 feet away, opposite the Flavors restaurant, and spread out along that area.
Brilliant. So people can just come down and see you guys there.
Definitely.
Great. Thank you, Richard and Richard, for joining me. And I've just got a little sign off here, which is, my little message in a bottle would be this: let's do it, and let's do it now, or at least start it. And if you want to find out more via Facebook or Twitter, if you search hashtag Acampada Bristol, and I'll spell that, that's A-C-A-M-P-A-D-A Bristol, put that into Facebook and Twitter and you can find out more.
And as a brief addendum to that, well, thank you very much to Anna Antonio, Rich and Rich. They have an assembly there every day at 7 p.m. By assembly, I don't mean, you know, they take the register, but it's just sort of a group meeting and you can just chat about ideas and chat to people. It's like a public meeting every day at 7 at the camp. Palmyra Sullivan. She's a lady who now lives in Bristol, but she was brought up in Spain by Republican parents. Here she talks about Guernica to Dialects reporter Anthea Page.
Hello, Palmyra.
Hello.
Can you tell us about Guernica?
Yes, Guernica is a small town in the Basque Country, which is world famous for a very sad and tragic event that happened on the 26th of April 1937 during the Spanish Civil War. And that was the complete destruction of the town by German bombers. Well, it is alleged that that was part of a kind of rehearsal for carpet bombing in the Second World War. Guernica, people say, why was Guernica chosen? It was a small town It was not a military objective, definitely. The Times correspondent who was in Bilbao at the time and went to Guernica straight away says there was a small arms factory outside the town that was not bombed, and there was also a barracks outside the town and that was not bombed either. So why was Guernica chosen? It was because Guernica had been the Basque capital. It had tremendous symbolic significance for the Basques. The old Basque parliament was there, and in fact is still there because it was one of the very few buildings. It's up on a hill just outside the town. One of the very few buildings that was not bombed. But for the Basque, this old parliament was very important. Guernica was the place where the kings of Spain came to swear that they would respect the ancient laws of the Basque country in return for the allegiance of the Basques. But the old parliament always has an oak tree. This is reputedly where the swearing was done. There is still an oak tree. There's always a cutting taken from the oak tree. A new tree is always in reserve from when the old one dies. Symbolically, Guernica was really important to the Basques. And what the Germans and Franco's side on the war wanted to do was to really destroy the morale of the population. George Steer, the Times correspondent, was in Bilbao at the time. He went to Guernica and he spoke to the survivors. He reported what he saw, really. The report was written the following day, have it here, April 27, 1937. The British public was made aware of the full horror of this bombing. Guernica, the most ancient town of the Basques and the center of their cultural tradition, was completely destroyed yesterday afternoon by insurgent air raiders. The bombardment of the open town lasted precisely 3 hours and a quarter, during which a powerful fleet of airplanes consisting of three German types, Junkers, Heinkel bombers and Heinkel fighters, did not cease unloading on the town, bombs weighing from 1,000 pounds downwards. It is calculated that more than 3,000 incendiary devices were dropped on the town, and the Heinkel fighters, meanwhile, plunged low from above the center of the town to machine gun those of the civilian population who had taken refuge in the fields. So you can see how incredibly horrible this was. The tactic was to scare people into going into the air raid shelters by machine gunning them and dropping some bombs. Then the building were destroyed by very heavy bombs, and everything was set on fire by the incendiaries. So the people who were sheltering in the basement of the houses were either crushed and burnt, or they were driven out, and when they were trying to run away, they were machine gunned. First hand grenades and heavy bombs to stampede the population, then machine gunning to drive them below, and next heavy and incendiary bombs to wreck the houses and burn them on top of their victims. The other thing that is important is that the day chosen for the bombing was market day. So all the farmers from the surrounding area were in town. There were many more victims than there would have been otherwise. After the bombing, Franco's side tried to persuade people that the town had been burnt by the Basque nationalists themselves. But, of course, that was not believed abroad, and I mean, Franco's propaganda machine totally failed in that way. George Thier, actually, the Times correspondent, found some casings of bombs which had still had the markings of the German factories and the Imperial Eagle on them. So it was very clearly, and there are, apart from George Thier, who wasn't actually there when the bombing happened, but came afterwards and interviewed the survivors, but there's a very famous eyewitness account by a priest, someone called Canon Onaindia, which has been very widely reported and believed. And he obviously saw the German planes, as did lots of other people. So the town has been rebuilt, but the story of Guernica, of course, is very symbolic of the horrors of war.
Was this the most significant atrocity during the war against civilians?
Well, there were so many atrocities against civilians in the Spanish Civil War. If you read the history books, there are accounts of bombings, of columns of refugees walking along the road, of people imprisoned in a bullring in a town and just shot. There were so many civilians killed, of course, on both sides, but I think Franco's side was particularly cruel because Franco wanted to, once and for all, crush the left and make sure that they would never raise their head again. So the war was unbelievably cruel, and also the repression after the war. Guernica was very striking because it all happened in 3.25 hours, and it was just so meaningless, because in other cases you could see that Franco's side were killing their enemies. But these were Germans, for God's sake, who had no part in the war, shouldn't have had any part in the war, bombing a population which was full of civilians, no military objective. No reason to bomb it at all, except that for its symbolic reason. So really, it was particularly horrible because it was so quick, so ruthless, and so motiveless, if you like.
Thank you very much to Palmira O'Sullivan talking to Anthony Page about Guernica. Next week you can hear part two of that interview, in which Palmira discusses the famous painting of Guernica by Picasso and the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War.
Malcolm Grieve now reads chapter 7 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Thank you. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 2, The Sea Cook. Chapter 7, I Go to Bristol. It was longer than the Squire imagined ere we were ready for the sea, and none of our first plans, not even Dr. Livesey's of keeping me beside him, could be carried out as we intended. The doctor had to go to London for a physician to take charge of his practice. The Squire was hard at work in Bristol, and I lived on at the Hall under the charge of old Redruth, the gamekeeper, almost a prisoner, but full of sea dreams and the most charming anticipations of strange islands and adventures. I brooded by the hour together over the map, all the details of which I well remembered. Sitting by the fire in the housekeeper's room, I approached that island, in my fancy, from every possible direction. I explored every acre of its surface. I climbed 1,000 times to that tall hill they call the Spyglass, and from the top enjoyed the most wonderful and changing prospects. Sometimes the isle was thick with savages, with whom we fought. Sometimes full of dangerous animals that hunted us. But in all my fancies, nothing occurred to me so strange and tragic as our actual adventures. So the weeks passed on, till one fine day there came a letter addressed to Dr. Livesey, with this addition, to be opened, in the case of his absence, by Tom Redruth or young Hawkins. Obeying this order, we found, or rather I found, for the gamekeeper was a poor hand at reading anything but print, the following important news. Old Anchor Inn, Bristol, March the 1st. Dear Livesey, as I do not know whether you are at the Hall or still in London, I send this in double to both places. The ship is bought and fitted. She lies at anchor, ready for sea. You never imagined a sweeter schooner. A child might sail her. 200 tons, name Hispaniola. I got her through my old friend Blandley, who has proved himself throughout the most surprising trump. The admirable fellow literally slaved in my interest, and so, I may say, did everyone in Bristol, as soon as they got wind of the port we sailed for. Treasure, I mean. Redruth, said I, interrupting the letter, Dr. Livesey will not like that. The Squire has been talking, after all.
Well, who's a better right? Growled the gamekeeper. A pretty rum go of Squire ain't to talk for Dr. Livesey, I should think.
At that, I gave up all attempt at commentary, and read straight on. Blandley himself found the Hispaniola, and by the most admirable management got her for the merest trifle. There is a class of men in Bristol monstrously prejudiced against Blandley. They go to the length of declaring that this honest creature would do anything for money, that the Hispaniola belonged to him, and that he sold it me absurdly high. The most transparent calumnies. None of them dare, however, to deny the merits of the ship. So far there was not a hitch. The workpeople, to be sure, riggers and whatnot, were most annoyingly slow, but time cured that. It was the crew that troubled me. I wished a round score of men, in case of natives, buccaneers, or the odious French. And I had the worry of the deuce itself to find so much as half a dozen, till the most remarkable stroke of fortune brought me the very man that I required. I was standing on the dock when, by the merest accident, I fell in talk with him. I found he was an old sailor, kept a public house, knew all the seafaring men in Bristol, had lost his health ashore and wanted a good berth as cook to get back to sea again. He had hobbled down there that morning, he said, to get a smell of the salt. I was monstrously touched, and out of pure pity I engaged him on the spot to be ship's cook. Long John Silver he is called, and he has lost a leg. But that I regard as a recommendation, since he lost it in his country's service under the immortal Hawk. He has no pension, Livesey. Imagine the abominable age we live in. Well, sir, I thought I had only found a cook, but it was a crew I had discovered. Between Silver and myself, we got together in a few days a company of the toughest old salts imaginable. Not pretty to look at, but fellows by their faces of the most indomitable spirit. I declare we could fight a frigate. Long John even got rid of 2 out of the 6 or 7 I had already engaged. He showed me in a moment that they were just the sort of freshwater swabs we had to fear in an adventure of this importance. I am in the most magnificent health and spirits, eating like a bull, sleeping like a tree. Yet I shall not enjoy a moment till I hear my old tarpaulins tramping round the capstan. Seaward ho!
Hang the treasure, it's the glory of the sea that has turned my head. So now, Livesey, come post. Do not lose an hour if you respect me. Let young Hawkins go at once to see his mother, with Redruth for a guard, and then both come full speed to Bristol. John Trelawney. Postscript. I did not tell you that Blandley, who by the way is to send a consort after us if we don't turn up by the end of August, has found an admirable fellow for sailing master. A stiff man, which I regret, but in all other respects a treasure. Long John Silver unearthed a very competent man for a mate, a man named Arrow. I have a boatswain who pipes, Lizzie, so things shall go man-of-war fashion on board the good ship Hispaniola. I forgot to tell you that Silver is a man of substance. I know of my own knowledge that he has a banker's account, which has never been overdrawn. He leaves a wife to manage the inn, and as she is a woman of colour, a pair of old bachelors like you and I might be excused for guessing that it is the wife, quite as much as the health, that sends him back to roving. J.T. P.P.S. Hawkins may stay one night with his mother. J.T. You can fancy the excitement into which the letter put me. I was half beside myself with glee. And if I ever despised a man, it was old Tom Redruth, who could do nothing but grumble and lament. Any of the under-gamekeepers would gladly have changed places with him, but such was not the squire's pleasure, and the squire's pleasure was like law among them all. Nobody but old Redruth would have dared so much as even to grumble. The next morning he and I set out on foot for the Admiral Benbow, and there I found my mother in good health and spirits. The captain, who had so long been the cause of so much discomfort, was gone with a wicked cease from troubling. The squire had had everything repaired, and the public rooms in the sign repainted, and had added some furniture, above all a beautiful armchair for my mother in the bar. He had found her a boy as an apprentice also, so that she should not want for help while I was gone. It was on seeing that boy that I understood for the first time my situation. I had thought up to that moment of the adventures before me, not at all of the home that I was leaving. And now, at the sight of this clumsy stranger who was to stay here in my place beside my mother, I had my first attack of tears. I am afraid I led that boy a dog's life. For as he was new to the work, I had 100 opportunities for setting him right and putting him down, and was not slow to profit by them. The night passed, and the next day after dinner Redruth and I were afoot again and on the road. I said goodbye to my mother and the cove where I had lived since I was born, and the dear old Admiral Benbow, since he was repainted, no longer quite so dear. One of my last thoughts was of the captain, who had so often strode along the beach with his cocked hat, his sabre-cut cheek and his old brass telescope. Next moment we had turned the corner, and my home was out of sight. The mail picked us up about dusk at the Royal George on the heath. I was wedged between Redruth and a stout old gentleman, and in spite of the swift motion and the cold night air, I must have dozed a great deal from the very first, and then slept like a log, uphill and down dale through stage after stage. For when I was awakened at last, it was by a punch in the ribs, and I opened my eyes to find that we were standing still before a large building in a city street, and that the day had already broken a long time. "Where are we?" I asked. "Bristol," said Tom. "Get down." Mr. Trelawney had taken up his residence at an inn far down the docks to superintend the work upon the schooner. Thither we had now to walk, and our way, to my great delight, lay along the quays and beside the great multitude of ships of all sizes and rigs and nations. In one, sailors were singing at their work. In another, there were men aloft, high over my head, hanging to threads that seemed no thicker than a spider's. Though I had lived by the shore all my life, I seemed never to have been near the sea till then. The smell of tar and salt was something new. I saw the most wonderful figureheads that had all been far over the ocean. I saw, besides, many old sailors with rings in their ears and whiskers curled in ringlets and tarry pigtails, and their swaggering, clumsy sea walk. And if I had seen as many kings and archbishops, I could not have been more delighted. And I was going to see myself, to sea in a schooner with a piping boatswain and pigtailed singing seamen. To sea, bound for an unknown island, and to seek for buried treasures. While I was still in this delightful dream, we came suddenly in front of a large inn and met Squire Trelawney, all dressed out like a sea officer in stout blue cloth, coming out of the door with a smile on his face and a capital imitation of a sailor's walk. "Here you are," he cried, "and the doctor came last night from London. Bravo, the ship's company complete." "Oh, sir," cried I, "when do we sail?" "Sail," says he, "we sail tomorrow."
That was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Time for some poetry now, and I'd like to introduce Mr. Mark Sayers once again. Hello.
Hello. This is a poem I wrote when I was living in North Yorkshire for 14 years. It's called "You Don't Come From Round Here, Do You?" "You don't come from round here, do you?" he said. Might this have put James firmly in his place? How long before he gets the go-ahead? Breathtaking hills and wild bleak moors instead of placid fields. How James loves all this space. "You don't come from round here, do you?" he said. Why are James' friends mostly those who have spread their wings and moved to North Yorkshire's showcase? How long before he gets the go-ahead? The southern charm of Mere or Maidenhead, does he miss? How long before he'll embrace? "You don't come from round here, do you?" he said. Sweeping through the weald, a tornado shed, trees like leaves. "Serve 'em right," said Joe with grace. How long before James gets the go-ahead? How long before he will no longer dread blocking the hackneyed phrases he must face? "The beer down south is like gnat's piss," Jack said. Is James likely to get the go-ahead?
Thank you very much. How long ago did you write that? How long ago were you living in Yorkshire?
Oh, 5 years ago.
Okay. What sent you up there in the first place?
Well, I used to work in this area, and then I was working with Usher's Brewery, and then that they started massive reorganisations. I was made redundant.
All right. Well, what do you do as a poet, sort of out in public? Do you perform anywhere particularly?
All I do is belong to a number of groups of people who like poetry. I run my own group at Eugenie House on Royal York Crescent, courtesy of the residents. And then I belong to one at the Lansdowne in Clifton.
Okay, yes.
And then there's one at the Cafe Kino, where I was this morning, in Stokes Croft.
Yes.
And then I hop on the bus and go down to Weston-super-Mare, where there's a lovely crowd of people who meet there.
It sounds like sort of a polite beer crawl, so it's like a poetry crawl. You can sort of like go from poetry thing to
thing. That's right. It's a sort of glorified pub crawl, really. But yeah.
Do you get sort of very different atmospheres in different poetry groups?
Yes, you do, rather. You sometimes find, you know, there's a frightfully smart person organising it who rules the roost very much.
Yeah.
Now it's your turn, Harry. And then it switches to the other end of the room. But it's rather amusing, I find.
Yeah.
You have to be careful not to write poems about groups like that.
Have you ever been tempted and then kept it to yourself?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, on the whole, I meet some absolutely fascinating people, and they're a joy to be with.
Okay. How could people sort of find out more about these groups? How did you find out about them?
Well, there's a newsletter published by Poetry Can in Bristol.
Okay.
And they give a monthly newsletter which you can access, and it gives details of the groups in Bath and in Bristol and in various other...
Do you know, is that on the web?
Yes.
Know? Poetry Can.
Poetry Can, yes.
Bristol.
Yep.
Bristol. All right, well, thank you very much for that heads up. We'll investigate that possibly and mention it in future weeks. Mark Sayers, thank you very much.
Not at all, thank you.
It's time for a What's On guide. Jeff Sparks is away at the moment, so let's introduce Sophia Costa. Hello.
Hello. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, the 17th of June, BSPRI will be running an event titled Ghostfest Southwest 2011 at St. Bribal's Castle in Lydney, Gloucestershire. This event will combine 2 nights overnight investigations as well as stalls, experiments and talks from guest speakers such as Haunted Britain's Richard Jones and also Dr. Citrin O'Keefe. Tickets are £45 for 1 night and £80 for both nights, and the costs include overnight investigation, accommodation, breakfast and also the talks. If you prefer to just come along to the talks, then it's £20. This event will also be raising money for the Muscular Dystrophy Campaign. To book tickets, please send cheques paid payable to Ghostfest Southwest to Wendy Isaacs. That's Ghostfest Southwest event organiser. On 14 Chatscombe Yate, Bristol, BS37 4JD. Along with your cheques, please include a full name and that of anyone else you're booking for, your full postal address and which night you want to attend. If you have any questions about the event, then contact ghostfest.southwest@live.co.uk. Now on to Song of the Week, and I present Watts. This group formed in 2006 and to date has released 2 albums. This is the title track from the album On the Dial, which was released in 2011. Watts with the title track from the album On the Dial. For more information on them, you can check out their Facebook page, Watts Rock. On Saturday the 18th of June, John E. Vistick will be performing with support from Rasp Thorn and the Briars, Dirty Roger and also DJ Paul Moyon at Mr. Wolf's in St. Stephen Street, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is £3.50 on the door. Finally, Sunday 19th of June, Charles Steen will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. This is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Sophia, and thank you also to Jeff, who hopefully will be back with us soon.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 3 p.m. every Sunday. And it's broadcast on Preston FM, and we're also broadcast in St Albans on Radio Value Lamb.
If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that at or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our studio guests, Antonia, Anna, Rich and Rich. Also to the poet Mark Sayers. Also to Sophie Costa for reading the What's On Guide, written by Jess Sparks. Reporter this week was Anthea Page. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyce and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk.
Next week, more Treasure Island. Well, that was Dialect.
I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. We wish you a very good week. From all the team in Queen Square, thank you very much for listening. Until next week, goodbye.
Kano, 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 manye, kano. We, kano. beni darabile Jom beni darabile Jom beni darabile Jom beni darabile Allah 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 We Allah 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 man satalati We Allah Karim Karim Masatala no la leti Oui Allah